The TNT Shop has great gift ideas for your furry family member. And we don't mean your Aunt Dolores.
You stink!
The TNT Shop has it all. At TNTRadio.live. You're listening to George Eliason, live from Donbas, Ukraine, on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome to the Friday show. Yesterday was a very, very interesting broadcast. I want to talk about Ukraine a little bit. I'd actually probably be better off talking about that to a degree. It is now, our guest, you know, has an opposing point of view. And quite frankly, you know, it's very dangerous because what Dr. Grant wants and people like her is for people like you to be willing to go to Ukraine and fight and die there. So it's not important to agree with what they have to say. It is important to know why, to get down to the bottom line of the why. Why? Why is it important to them personally? Is it some secret set of facts that, you know, I, the journalist who's been covering this for 9 years, won a couple of awards, don't know? And, you know, in the realm of possibility, you have to accept, well, okay, that might be a possibility. Maybe she knows something. Maybe she has some facts. Maybe, and with, especially with people that you disagree with, you have to stop and listen. It's really, really important. And it's not a matter of, you know, trying to be fair or trying to be this or trying to be that. It's not a matter of trying to be understanding. But it's understanding exactly where they're coming from, what's driving them. Because, you know, there's no point trying to change your mind. But if you know where they're coming from, it's not a matter of conjecture anymore. Why is Joe Biden doing what he's doing? When you know that for sure, because he said so, well, then you can act. Then you can make intelligent decisions yourself. Then you can go forward. Now, the story I wanted to start out with is a Ukraine story. And this is, you know, from my perspective, it's a very old story, but it's re-upping again because another Ukrainian official, this is an advisor to Volodymyr Zelensky, it's Mykhailo Mykhailovich Podolyak. He served as the advisor to the head of the office for President of Ukraine. And in 2022, he became one of the representatives of Ukraine at Russian-Ukrainian peace negotiations. Now, what did he have to say? Mykhailo Podolyak actually said that it's time to, they could do it within 3 months. They need to eradicate Russian sympathizers across Ukraine. He called for physically eradicating Ukrainian people across Ukraine. What is a Russian sympathizer? It's someone that isn't a nationalist. And it is that the line is that fine. If you don't agree that Stepan Bandera is a representation of the Son of God, and I mean this in almost a very literal way because they worship him in church, you are a sympathizer of Russia. If you're an Orthodox, Ukrainian Orthodox, you are a sympathizer with Russia. If you don't go to if you didn't go to Maidan and support them, If, I mean, the list can go on and on and on. If you don't think Azov Battalion are great guys, if, you know, whatever, however that goes. And this eradication has been going on. It is ongoing, and it has been since 2014. And they're taking these people, and they're throwing them to the front lines. Here's 8 bullets, go. And they're literally doing that to people, by the way. Here's 8 bullets, go. No direction, no nothing. Go in that direction over there. Well, what's over there? We don't know. But go over there anyway. And that's part of the reason why the death toll is so high. It isn't that totally that Russia's that good or Ukraine's that bad. It's Russia's, Ukraine and Zelensky are getting rid of their political opposition. Easiest way to do that is attrit in. And unfortunately, that is the hallmark of this war. Now, we're going to go into the news break with D.D. Denslow, and we'll be back in a second.
Your news when you need it.
They cover the important story.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And welcome back. We've got the illustrious TNT host and producer D.D. Denslow in the house for the news segment. D.D., how are you today and what's going on?
I'm very well, George. I hope you are well too. It's Friday. And I have actually already done this story once today, but the UFO topic, if I haven't told you already, George, is something, it's not just close to my heart. It is a private, a lifelong obsession, what is flying in our skies. And in recent years, this topic has become more mainstream. It is not ridiculed in the press like it was just 6 years ago, 7 years ago, where if I had spoken to a fellow science teacher about the UFO topic, they would have looked down at the ground or just called me crazy. But now there are public hearings even in America. In fact, there have been 3 public hearings congressional hearings on the UFO topic. 2 of them have happened in the last year, and the other happened 50 years ago. So you can see how there's been this big gap in actually discussing this topic. So the public hearing on the 19th was the 3rd Congress has ever held about UFOs, with the most recent one taking place in 2022, or more than 50 years since the very first hearing in 1969. Up until 2017, UFOs were not up for discussion at all, and governments denied they were even investigating the subject. There has been some discussion on cases, and there have been approximately 650 possible cases of unidentified flying objects that are being monitored or investigated by the US government, but there may be no aliens or extraterrestrial life to worry about. Of those 650, we've prioritized about half of them to be an anomalous or interesting value, says Sean Kirkpatrick, the director of the All Domain Anomaly Resolution Office, or AARO, I'm assuming that is said. And that is a subcommittee of the Emergent Threats and Capabilities. The majority of unidentified objects reported to ARO demonstrated mundane characteristics such as clutter, natural phenomena, weather balloons, hobby balloons, and Chinese spy balloons, or other readily explained sources. 72.2% of UFOs, now named UAPs, unidentified aerial phenomenon, are found in the 15,000 to 30,000 foot range, where a lot of aircraft do inhabit that part of the sky. And there were some examples of cases given where ones turned out to have a propeller. So I'm guessing that was probably a plane, George. But there have been some other sightings, a lot of silver orbs in the Middle East and now in Asia. These have actually been observed by drones. There's photographs and videos of these objects, and they appear to be able to perform physical feats of propulsion that at least in the white world, the visible world, we don't have that type of technology. And I'm talking, you know, instantaneous acceleration from zero to max speeds, turning at right angles at great speeds, things like that. There is a possible aerial threat from China and Russia, for example. Maybe they've developed hypersonic drones. My personal opinion, and this is the question that I'm coming to you with, George, is that I believe that some of these objects may actually be American technology, and they're using the UFO cover to demonstrate it to their enemies, i.e. Russia and China. Final comment from Sean Kirkpatrick. He says, I should also state clearly for the record that in our research, Aero has found no credible evidence thus far of extraterrestrial activity, off-world technology, or objects that defy the known laws of physics. And I believe that that final statement, objects that defy the known laws of physics, may well be untrue when referring back to some of the observations and footage and evidence that's readily available, even to the most common of people. If you search hard enough on YouTube, there are objects in our skies that are doing things that cannot be explained, George. So I'm interested to know what your opinion is on the UFO topic, mate.
Well, I just actually, I listened to an interview with Elon Musk the other day, and he was asked specifically about this topic, and he said, and it was with Tucker Carlson, and he said, you know, Tucker, if there's one single person in this, on this planet, that would know anything about UFOs or life on other planets, it's me, because I've looked into it so much and I've put so much money into it, looking into it so much. And he said, we haven't found anything anywhere. As far as we know and we can prove today, we're alone in the universe. And, you know, it's something that this is the guy that actually, he wants to find it. Me, I don't have an opinion on it at all. In terms of the things that, you know, we've seen, I haven't seen anything you know, in terms of the video available or photos or whatever, anything conclusive enough to convince me on it either way. You know, they haven't, if they're out there, they haven't destroyed us yet.
That's good.
Which is good.
Yeah.
And they haven't said hello yet, which is bad. But what Musk was talking about, he said, you know, we're in a situation that right now where, and the whole thing was revolving, that it ramped up to that because it started off with AI and where AI is going. And he got into what they call the singularity.
Yeah.
And that's what actually, you know, jumped into this conversation. And the singularity is an event where, you know, that leads to what? Your extinction event?
Yeah. Well, it's the ultimate in AI event, isn't it? The singularity. It's something that Kurzweil exactly. has talked about a lot, where we have artificial general intelligence. He talked about how it can double its knowledge, the amount of knowledge or information it has every couple of years. And it's basically
every 2.5 years.
And its starting point is all the knowledge that's ever been recorded by humans in human history ever. That's its starting place. And, you know, with machine learning. I mean, it may well be, if there are extraterrestrials, if there are other life forms out there in the universe, they would also develop artificial intelligence. And they may actually send that out into the universe to overcome things like the barriers of time and the barriers of biology. Yeah, because it's difficult for us to travel long distances because we're stuck in these meat sacks, George. I am a firm believer in UFOs, and I will try to maybe up your Elon Musk, with somebody who's not quite as rich, with a guy called Robert Bigelow, who claims to have spent more personal money, private money, investigating the UFO topic than any other person. And he is on record on CNN, not necessarily the most trustworthy or viable of sources, but on CNN, categorically saying that he knows that UFOs are real and that he knows they come from elsewhere. He didn't say from another planet. When I talk about UFOs myself and I say the word alien, I just mean not us. They could be from underground or under the oceans or on the far side of the moon or from another planet. Time travel, it could be any of these things, but I'm almost certain there's a there, George. I believe that there are objects recorded not just recently but throughout human history in our skies, and there's never been a credible or reasonable explanation as to what they are.
Well, fair enough. And you know, according to your definition, after this singularity, and you know, the AI programs are patting us on the head like cats. Maybe we might have those near to home aliens to deal with.
Yeah, we might be making the aliens ourselves, George.
Exactly. Didi, thank you so much for coming on today. My pleasure. And you have a great weekend, friend.
Have a great weekend, George, and I'll speak to you next week, mate.
All right. Now, if you've missed your favorite TNT radio show or interview, simply listen back when you want, wherever you want. Just visit episodes on the TNT radio website. We're also on all the major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, Podbean, iHeart, and TuneIn. Now, there's no reason to miss out on anything on TNT radio.
TNT Radio's Lynn Shaw.
I'm tired of this whole sexual predation against our children, against our girls, boys, youth, adults, everybody kind of being swept under the rug despite all of the noise, despite all the legislation that everybody's working on, despite everything. I am in fear that it will be buried with today's society, all the distractions, all the low-hanging fruit that surrounds all of us. So we got to buckle down, we got to stay in our lanes, we got to stay focused, and that starts in your home and in your community. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month. Now, I know it's a dark, ugly subject, but we must talk about it, because the more we raise awareness, the more we talk about it, the more we get it out in the open is the goal. The goal is always education. The goal is always providing resources. And remember, if we help one person, one child a day, then we've done our jobs. And that is why with this overwhelming, dark, ugly subject, all of this predation going on, if you keep that in mind, you help one person, one child a day, you can do it.
Lynn Shaw on TNT Radio. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. TNTRadio.live.
Online.
Streaming.
Be a part of the conversation.
I stream it all at work, and I stream it to my phone and listen to it wherever I go.
TNT.
And welcome back. We've got Dr. Kelly Victory with us today. She's a board-certified trauma and emergency specialist with over 30 years of clinical experience. She served as a chief medical officer for Whole Health Management, delivering on-site healthcare services for Fortune 500 companies. She holds a BS from Duke University and her MD from the University of North Carolina. And she is an expert on COVID and COVID policy. Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
That's just, I'm actually very excited because, I've listened to some of your interviews and you are uniquely qualified to discuss a side of COVID articulately that, you know, few people actually have, because they're more interested in origins of COVID or whatever. Now, I had a exec on a few months ago, and I asked him the difference between COVID and regular flu. I said, is it more dangerous than a regular flu? Well, no. Is it more contagious than any flu we've had in the last 20 years? He said, no. Is it more contagious than any flu we've had in the last 30 years or as long as they've been recording flus? He said, no, not particularly. Not more dangerous, not more deadly. I said, so what's behind all this? He said, well, politics and policymakers. That's what pushed everything the way it went, the direction it went, and pulled us along. And we went too. So that's how he described it. Now, that's not saying, you know, origins of it or how dangerous it is or anything else. But, you know, this was the first time, I mean, essentially a disease was handled like it had civil rights. And it was not medical practitioners or researchers driving the policy, but it was politicians. Would you agree that that's true?
Absolutely. Let me be very clear. COVID as a virus is very real, and it did pose a risk to a certain subsection of the population. From a public health perspective, however, the problem wasn't the virus. It was the response to the virus. And this will go down in history as the greatest public health failure of all time. The reality is that the vast majority of the population was not at any significant risk from this virus, as you've explained it, was not particularly virulent and was not particularly deadly if to most people. We knew who was at risk, yet the public health officials from the very beginning acted as if we were all at equivalent risk. And rather than applying the standard procedures that we would do in time of an outbreak, meaning you rally around and protect that small group who actually are the risk group and let everybody else go about their business, they instead employed this concept of lockdowns and making everybody, healthy people, stay inside. There is no such entity, George, as quarantining healthy people. You quarantine people who are ill, who are actively ill, or who are at very, very high risk. Asking healthy people to stay away from others isn't called quarantine. That's called tyranny. And it went off the rails from there. This was absolutely guided by politics, money, corruption, greed, malfeasance, and a lot of things. It sure as heck wasn't guided by anybody's real concern for public health.
Mm-hmm. Now, how, you know, you have a lot of outreach in the medical community. How were doctors reacting to this? I mean, they must have seen it across the board.
Yeah, well, you know, this is probably
at a personal level.
Absolutely. My greatest, probably the greatest tragedy for me was the response of my own colleagues, because we know it. I did not get what I said right, George, because I applied some social heuristic or because I'm a good guesser. We have known from the beginning of time, for example, that masks do nothing appreciable to stop the spread of respiratory right. viruses. We've known that lockdowns do far more harm than good. There is reason why we never employ a vaccine program in the midst of an active outbreak. There is no such entity as social distancing. It's a made-up construct, and on and on. Yet people bought into this, including my colleagues, including the medical complex. And I think it's for a number of reasons. First of all, 80% of physicians, tragically, are now employees. They are employed by large hospital systems, or they are employed by large groups, physician groups, and therefore they no longer have or feel that they have medical autonomy. So many of them simply, you know, sort of, you know, put up, you know, shut up to get along sort of thing. They didn't want to lose their jobs. other people, for whatever reason, bought into the propaganda because fear, unfortunately, fear is an incredibly powerful motivator. Fear really gets people to make very, very poor decisions. I teach an entire course on leadership in times of crisis, and you have to understand that if you are operating out of fear, you are going to be making very poor decisions. And I think that, unfortunately, physicians are human, and many of them bought into the propaganda and believed that they or their families or their loved ones were actually at significant risk from this virus.
Now, this question may be out of place, and forgive me if it is. What about the Hippocratic Oath?
That's not out of place at all. There was an absolute breach of the fundamental concept in medicine, which is first do no harm. We did incredible harm to people from everything. Again, when I say talk about something like masks, masking is not simply a nuisance. It's not just an inconvenience. It is harmful. It is not only physically harmful, and there are just leagues and leagues of studies proving that there is physical harm to wearing masks, but they are tremendously harmful from a psychological perspective, from a social perspective. They are dehumanizing. Likewise, the lockdowns not only weren't helpful, they were harmful. UNICEF estimates that 250,000 children starved to death globally as a result of supply chain issues because of the lockdown. Think about that. From a public health perspective, it is our mandate to consider the implications of any mitigation scheme on the entire population, not just a singular virus or a singular group of people being impacted by a virus. So yes, there was a tremendous breach of the Hippocratic Oath, and I'm not sure that we will ever, we meaning physicians and healthcare professionals, will ever regain the confidence of the public.
Unfortunately, I tend to agree with that statement, except for locally. At the local level, you know your doctor. And, you had doctors all over the place that were trying to do the right thing. And, you've got that in the mix, too. It wasn't, global, thankfully. It happened.
None of this could have happened without the complicity of the mainstream media and big tech, because
exactly.
There were people, all of this was really facilitated by the coordination of efforts to silence people like me. I was egregiously censored. I was canceled, censored, kicked off every social media platform, shut down. It was kind of a joke to see how long any particular interview would stay online before it got kicked off YouTube or Rumble or wherever else. I was in Twitter jail for over a year until Elon Musk took over and I was allowed back on. So none of this could have happened if there hadn't been a coordinated effort between the federal government, and it's very clear that there was, and big tech and the mainstream media. They were all reading from the same sheet and absolutely deriding, ridiculing, shaming, and censoring those few of us who dared to speak out. And what happens absolutely is that people start to self-censor. They think, I won't make that post or I won't do that interview because I don't want to be canceled. And therefore, if people are not able to avail themselves of the actual information, and much of what I was doing in the early days was simply trying to help people understand their true risk and to put their fear back in its righteous place so that they were able to make better decisions regarding their own health care. And that was simply not allowed because of the incredible amount of censorship that was happening.
Well, that I agree with you 100% on. And I'm an investigative journalist. That's actually my wheelhouse. And I went through the whole COVID trace, but I was a lot more interested in what you just described, which was information operations against people talking about it. And what I found was this, people that were former DHS heads working on, actually dependent on Anthony Fauci for their payroll, that were heading this effort against people like you. So it was quite interesting. It's sad, that it could happen, but the way they went about it and the way they tried to shape the entire narrative all the way through. And when I investigated COVID, I was looking for a start date. And there was one particular day that really, really interested me. And I want to talk about that day right now. Up until this point, COVID had an R-naught value of 2.8. And that was until February 18, 19, 2020. And then it went vertical. It spiked to 5.7, the RO, in less than 36 hours globally, worldwide. Is this a result of the politics being involved and the information war, so that the actual diagnosis was for anything, you've got something in your eye, you've got COVID? I mean, is that what was going on?
I think largely, yes. We will never know. One of my taglines from the beginning has been, the virus is real, the statistics are not. We were using this highly faulty PCR test, which was never intended to be used the way that it was. The PCR test amplifies minuscule, insignificant fragments of virus that don't mean that you are actually ill or not. Never before COVID had we called something, quote, a case of something if the individual was asymptomatic. For all you know, maybe we're having a pandemic of tuberculosis, pandemic of God knows what, right, and a bunch of asymptomatic. Maybe it's patently absurd. On top of it, so number one, you have people who are asymptomatic coming back with a, quote, positive PCR test and being counted. Then you have people who got tested 3, 4, 5, 6 times over a particular period, and they each time they were counted as a positive case. So one individual can't be, five cases, yet that's how it was counted. On top of it, then you had this perverse financial incentive where hospitals and doctors were being paid tens of thousands of dollars for every case that they had. So they were highly motivated to report things as a positive case. We didn't test people for things like influenza or strep throat or any of the other things that could have had very similar symptomatology. So we will never know exactly how many people had COVID and who didn't, and how many people actually were admitted with COVID or died of COVID, because the statistics were grossly, grossly flawed.
Now, the baseline that I used was, are you familiar with the Diamond Princess cruise ship?
Oh, sure.
Case study. Sure. That was the baseline. Now, can you imagine all these, what was it, like 300 people on it?
Something like 330, that. I think, something like that.
In a confined space, they can't get away from each other. They're stuck together for weeks, and the R-naught value is 2.28. That was it the whole time. Well, now, can you explain to the listeners what the R-naught is?
Well,
you can do it a little easier than I can.
Yeah, without getting into the too far into the weeds on it, it's fundamentally a way of measuring how contagious, how transmissible a particular pathogen is. How many people you need to be exposed to in order to transmit the virus, or in this case, a virus, actively to somebody else. So the higher the R-naught is, the higher the transmissibility is of a particular pathogen. The reality is what you're talking about with this Diamond Prison, the Princess Cruise Line, is that you have people who have active virus in an enclosed space, and lo and behold, they didn't have a massive outbreak where everybody became ill. And that is the reality of COVID. Many, many people, quote, had it, were exposed to it, and had nary a symptom. It simply wasn't a particularly overwhelmingly lethal or virulent virus to most people. We knew from the beginning that the people who were at high risk had a very well-described set of comorbidities, and obesity, diabetes, and heart disease really, in addition to advanced age, were really the risk factors. And so those were the folks who did seem to develop worse symptoms. Tragically, and the thing that's really the elephant in the room, is that on top of all the rest of this, we had ready access to safe, inexpensive medications to treat COVID from the very beginning. And anyone who tells you otherwise,
We're going to get into that. Yes, I saw that interview too. And it's very, very important because there's a lot of questions I have about that. Now, I want to give, we have the R-naught for COVID. In that confined space, from the report, actually studying the people, 2.28, what is the average for seasonal influenza? You know, just as a comparison.
I can't tell you offhand, but I would say it's probably similar. They're similar.
2.21.
Yeah, something like that.
2.21. It's the same. The 1918 pandemic was 2.28. Mm-hmm. 2009 pandemic was 1.6. And we're looking at something that doesn't, it's very difficult to spread, even when it's very, very dangerous, like 1918, but COVID wasn't. It's everything that you're talking about right now. Before we get into what could have been done, and this is going to lead into early treatment, you know, as a discussion, why would the U.S. government, why would the CDC, why would even regular, you know, media, it should be common sense, you know, you treat a cold, you treat a flu, okay? You feed a cold, start with flu, or is it opposite that?
Yes.
Which
feed
is
a
it?
Cold, right. Well, yeah, old wives' tale, feed a cold, starve a fever. But the reality is, yeah, people lost their common sense and acted as if, you know, oh my gosh, I've got a fever. What should I do? I'm thinking the same thing you would always do if you have a fever. Take some Tylenol. I have a cough. What should I do? I'm thinking, how about some cough medicine? You know, it's as if people went into this fugue state and lost all common sense because, again, they were being led to believe that COVID was some kind of it's a novel virus.
Right.
Oh my gosh, as if we haven't had leagues of novel viruses beforehand.
Well, it sounds radical. It's novel. Okay.
Yeah.
We haven't seen it before. Why would all these institutions, public health, this is where the public trust thing comes in, and why I describe COVID as having civil rights, did they put their feet down against treating it in any way, shape, or form? Why did they do that?
I believe it's a complex question, but I believe fundamentally that this was always about getting the mRNA vaccine platform to become a household word. The only way you could get the mRNA vaccines out to the public was under an emergency use authorization, because vaccinology is very complex, and there's a reason that the average vaccine takes 6 to 8 years to come to market, if it ever comes to market at all. In order to get an emergency use authorization and bring that mRNA platform to the public in under a year, you have to submit two things. Number one, that you have reason to believe that the vaccine will prevent you from contracting the illness. And number two, there are no other treatments. And that's the key part. If they had acknowledged that there were other treatments available for COVID, we could talk about what those are, then by law, they could not get an emergency use authorization for the vaccines. And I use that term loosely, vaccine, for these gene therapies. And I believe this has been an interest of the powers that be, from the World Health Organization to Bill Gates and the CDC and the FDA, have been interested in getting mRNA technology to become a household word. And this was the most expedient way to do it.
Next question then. Now, they can only do it if there's no other way to do it. They persecuted and prosecuted doctors that were actually trying to treat their patients that saw issues because of vaccine injuries. Okay, that's also a real thing. Are they liable for those prosecutions? Here's the thing I don't understand is, why can't an MD grab a stack of papers, go to court and say, okay, here's the evidence. Okay. The federal government and, policymakers and whoever you want to throw into it screwed us all. And now they went after me, they hurt my business, and I want damages.
Oh, this is a huge, huge issue, George. They have destroyed the lives and livelihoods of many physicians because here's how they did it. They weaponized the regulatory bodies. They weaponized the state medical boards so that physicians had their licenses threatened and in many cases revoked, or in cases of people like Dr. Peter McCullough, who many people have been following, who is a friend and colleague, his licensing board, the Internal Board of Internal Medicine and the American College of Cardiology, took away his board certification. Once you lose your board certification, you can even have a license, but no hospital will allow you on staff and insurance companies won't reimburse you. So they destroyed your license and destroyed your livelihood. It's enormous. So yes, you can take them to court and maybe in 5 or 6 years, you'll win that court case. But in the meantime, your life and your livelihood have been decimated. They were doing things akin to what you see in places like the former Soviet Union or North Korea. There are physicians who were remanded to psychiatric evaluation for daring to prescribe ivermectin. I mean, this is absolutely horrific what has happened to physicians. And you can take it to court, but you need a lot of resources. There are many, many different organizations that have been rallying to help physicians who have been targeted. I was able to successfully defend myself against 7 separate complaints to my medical licenses in various states. Interestingly, not for anything I did with a patient, but for things I've said on shows like this one. I've had complaints registered against me. And as a physician, you are required to mount a defense, and it's debilitating. It takes incredible amounts of time and resources. I have been successful each time, but don't think it does take a toll, and it's incredibly dangerous and unfair. And unfair, by the way, not just to physicians, but you as a patient, everyone listening to this as a patient, it is terrifying to think that your physician may be telling or suggesting that you do something, not because he or she believes it's correct, but because they don't want to lose their medical license. I mean, that's terrifying.
Yeah, it is. Now, before we go any further, this conversation is going way too fast. We're not covering a lot of ground, and we're running out of time. And this is all great information. So before we go any further, because I don't want to be remiss with this, where can people find you, and how can people support what you're doing?
Well, I appreciate that. The only social media platform that I have is Twitter, and I'm at Dr. Kelly Victory. Unlike 98% of people on Twitter, I actually use my real name, so at Dr. Kelly Victory on Twitter. And then I'm associated with the website earlycovidcare.org. That's a website that was put together with a number of other experts, including people like Dr. Pierre Corey and Peter McCullough and Harvey Reich and other great leaders who have had the guts, like me, to be out from the very beginning talking about these things. And earlycovidcare.org is not an anti-vaccine website. What it is a hopefully a repository for a lot of information. There are hundreds of scientific articles, scientific studies posted there on everything from masking to lockdowns to vaccine issues. There are lots of resources for people who have been perhaps vaccine injured, how to contact a physician who is familiar with the protocols for how to treat vaccine injury and those sorts of things.
Now, Dr. Kelly, we have 8 minutes left. Now, we're talking about COVID. We're talking about the vaccines being dangerous. You just mentioned in passing you're, you know, not against vaccines. Okay. Now, I take a few minutes and explain that again. And then I'd appreciate it if you run out the clock talking about the actually early treatments, which were ended up being contra vaccine, which is crazy, but that's just the way it ended up because of the persecutions, prosecutions, and whatever, what you just described.
Sure.
Because, well, for starters, all these things are important.
Absolutely. With regard to these vaccines, as I said, you're correct. I am not anti-vaccine. I think we may over-vaccinate people, and that's a conversation, you know, in and of itself that we can have. But there is a reason, as I said, that vaccines take as many years as they do to come to market. Many of them fail before they ever get across the finish line. It's complex business. The human immune system is perhaps the last great frontier of medicine. The immune system doesn't always respond the way that we think it will. And sometimes a vaccine appears to be very helpful or very useful or like it's going to be quite efficacious early on. And then lo and behold, 24, 36, you know, 72 months later, we find ill effects or adverse effects that we hadn't anticipated, and therefore it doesn't make it to the market. Very early on with these, quote, vaccines, we had clear evidence of adverse events, and we now know from the vast pile of documents that have been released based on aggressive FOIA requests. These are documents that Pfizer and Moderna hoped to keep silent for 75 years. They've now been released, and it is absolutely irrefutable that they knew of these adverse events before the vaccines were released to the public. They knew the vaccines caused myocarditis, inflammation of the heart. They knew that there were neurologic complications. They knew that there were vast fertility implications. They knew that there were carcinogenic implications, and they knew all of it before these were released to the public. The vaccines, as of today, as I sit here today, April 21st, 2023, are still entirely experimental. They are not FDA approved. There is no FDA approved vaccine for COVID available in the United States. So they're experimental. By the Nuremberg Code itself, it is illegal to mandate, coerce, or otherwise co-opt someone to participate against their will in a medical experiment. So the idea of ever having mandated these is absolutely, I mean, I can't even, I'm apoplectic. I don't even know what to say about it. It is so wrong, and it breaches every law, every rule, every ethical and moral construct that we have in medicine. They are experimental, and if people want to take one, God, you know, bless them. They have every right to do so. But likewise, people should have had always an absolute right to decline these. Then on to
your explanations at a totally different level than I had ever thought. So thank you.
Yeah. So and then we could talk. I'm happy to talk about why, you know, these mRNA vaccines are very, very dangerous and why there's a reason we've never had a successful mRNA vaccine in the past. You know, what you are doing is asking the body to create a a foreign substance. That's what the mRNA does. It tells your body, gives your body the roadmap, the instruction manual to start producing these spike proteins, with the idea being that your immune system will see it and develop antibodies. The problem is there's no off switch to your body producing those spike proteins. So you just keep producing them and keep producing them. And we have no idea for how long, and neither do they. They have no idea how long you'll continue to produce those, perhaps in perpetuity. So they're very, very problematic. And there's a reason we haven't used them previously. As I said, I think that the big reason that there was a hit job out and we were absolutely not allowed to talk about early treatment, of which there were many from the beginning, was because they would never have gotten that emergency use authorization if they acknowledged that there were treatments. And when it comes to those things, it's not, you know, despite what people heard in the mainstream media that, oh my God, you know, hydroxychloroquine, this incredibly dangerous drug, which, by the way, is taken by millions, hundreds of millions of people around the globe every day. Hydroxychloroquine has been FDA approved since 1942. Okay, we are six decades into this medication, you know, 7 decades into this medication being FDA approved. It's been on the list of essential medications for the WHO for decades. It's one of the most commonly used. It's over the counter in every country other than the United States and Canada. It's so safe. It's one of the few drugs that we give without any contraindication to pregnant women. I mean, we're talking about a drug that safety profile surpasses Tylenol, okay? And it costs about 2 cents a pill. Why did we think that that would work? Because Anthony Fauci and the NIH published a study in 2005 proving that hydroxychloroquine was incredibly effective against SARS-CoV-1, the SARS outbreak that happened in 2003. They knew, we all knew that these medications were there and readily available, safe and inexpensive.
Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for coming on today. I really hope to have you on again soon.
I'd be delighted to join you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again.